Can you remember the first book that really captured your imagination, the one that made you wish there were more and more from the same author that you could devour over time? That's what's known as the magic book, according to children's author and literacy campaigner Jackie French, who's on a mission to bring a love of reading and storytelling to rural children in particular this year as part of her role as the Australian Children's Laureate. Jackie French, welcome to A Country Breakfast.
Thank you. Hi.
Can you remember the first story that did that for you, magic book?
It was, in fact, The Magic Pudding. At the end of it, they all decide they're going to live in a market garden with all the fruit and vegetables they want to eat and lots of pudding and good conversation of an evening. And I thought, that is how I want to live. We so often ask kids, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up, dear? And a more reasonable question is, how do you want to live? Because if you want to live with a bush around you, if you want to live in a country area, you need to actually start thinking of choices that will keep you living in the way you want to live.
How hungry do you think children are these days for storytelling?
Incredibly. Whenever I go into meet with large groups of kids now, I say, okay, put up your hands. Who watched TV last night? Every hand goes up. Who was bored? 80% of hands go up. Why do you watch it? Because there was nothing else and because we hoped something interesting would come on. Parents are kids enablers. Kids can't read books if the books they want to read aren't there. But also, so many kids actually don't like kids' books. I remember one boy, a friend of my son, now a very, very, very well-established farmer, at the age of 12, they thought he couldn't read. But I'd got a book about diseases of chickens. We're talking a postgraduate veterinary textbook. I thought he'd like to look at the very interesting pictures of diseased chickens. He read it all afternoon. He left with it clasped to his chest. He rang up 3 days later and said, I've read it, but can I read it again? And come to think of it, that was about 25 years ago and I haven't got the book back. We need to be honest with our kids. We need to say, yes, most books are boring. I don't want to read about the lives of cricketers. I don't want to read about zombies, but you might want to. The other thing we need to do as well, we know to read to our little kids now, but when they're 5, 6, 7, 8, we say, oh, you're a big kid now. And we think they will read their own stories. But one of the other things I do is I ask even 8-year-olds, how many of you enjoy Game of Thrones? And again, we've got about 80% of hands going up. Now, I'm pretty sure they're not watching it at home. They're watching an illegally downloaded device of their friends.
Yes.
But you can't expect these kids to be satisfied with Spot's Big Adventure. We're losing our readers between about 5 and 10 because the books they really need, these wonderful, complex, fascinating books, all these really interesting technical books, they can't read yet.
Look, I managed to find a couple of kids who would tell me about their magic books. Let's have a little listen.
Lovely.
Well, the hungry little caterpillar.
The very hungry caterpillar. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And what was it about that book that you loved?
Well, I just liked the flappy bits about the fruit, and this was really interesting.
Okay, and do you have sort of particular memories about storytelling or story time that you think back on and you really loved?
Yeah, I liked it when Mummy used to read me storybooks at bedtime and I would snuck it in her lap.
Can you remember, Oliver, the first book you sort of read yourself that inspired you to want to learn to read or to keep reading?
I think it was the first Alex Rider novel, Stormbreaker.
Why that particular book?
I thought it was really exciting when Alex got stuck in a giant fish tank with a giant jellyfish in it. I really liked that.
And do you sort of have a particular memory or an idea of what made you love storytelling and reading?
I remember in kinder when our kinder teacher used to get a story and read it to the whole class, and I liked that.
Now, I've got a bit of a confession, Jackie, that's actually two of my children. We're keeping it in the family here on A Country Breakfast. But they did both raise an interesting point. Coco talked about, you know, snuggling up with me and having story time. And Ollie talked about his kinder teacher. And, you know, it's the two adults, I suppose, reading to them. Yeah. Are we never too old, I guess, to be read to?
When Dad was 88, we were still reading to each other and we were reading by phone. You are never too far away to read a story, whether it's by Skype, whether it's on the phone. And that was one of the great joys in the last years of my father's life, that we would actually reread and reread to each other.
Figures from the OECD show this huge disparity between children in rural and remote Australia, both in maths and literacy, compared to urban areas. What do you think is going on there?
I don't know, and I think we should know. Why is there this difference? Now, we know there isn't a difference in terms of university performance. We know there isn't a difference in IQ. It is quite possibly that we don't have continuity of teachers. In fact, I know definitely in some areas. In the last year, I've been getting kids to write into me about how they think school should be better. And overwhelmingly, in many rural areas, the comment has been, we just get to know them and then they leave.
There are some incredibly beautiful literary experiences for children online, whether it's books online, apps for books on tablets or iPads, things like that. What do you make of the influence of technology on reading? And, you know, is it all bad?
Oh, no, look, it makes it much more convenient. I love actually sort of eavesdropping, eye-dropping, whatever it is, when I'm on a plane, when I'm a trainer on a bus, seeing what the person next to me is actually reading, particularly on their device. And it used to be if I was sitting next to a businessman, they'd be reading business papers. But these days, I've noticed on their device, they're actually reading a novel because you can get away with it.
They're sneaking it in.
Wonderful. Last time I was at an airport, I was looking at all of these kids. And again, I looked to see what they were doing on their mobile devices. And they were reading books. The electronic books are incredibly convenient. But the statistics in the last 2 years are showing we love using them because you don't have to lug a heavy bag of books to school. They're fantastic. You don't have to lug all the books you want to read on the journey. But when you're at home, when you're snuggled up in bed, when you've got your feet up on the table with a really nice cup of tea, you actually want the paper in your hands.
The texture, yeah. So give us your top tips this morning. We're all about to go off and start our Saturday and get busy. What is the easiest way I can head out there and everyone else can too to help children or neighbours or whoever it might be find their magic book?
First tip, go to the library and get your kids to actually roam. Give them an hour and they can take out any books they want to. And tell them that you're going to read them these books. They don't have to read themselves. Just like any book, including in the adult section, including in the non-fiction section. If they want to read about tractors or history or cricketers' lives, they can. Any book. You will not criticise. Then start to read it to them, but just when you get to a really exciting bit, suddenly remember you've got to do something else and put it down, and I bet they will keep on reading. But also, start doing these bargains. You're going to clean your room, I'll read to you. You want me to iron your school uniform, darn when you've gone through your knees for the 95th time in your school trousers, cook your favourite dinner. Okay, I'll do these things for you, but in return, you have to read what I'd like to hear. You're going to have to read to me. Have household reading. But mostly have those books there. Go to the library and make sure that the kids have got a choice of books. And if it's boring, tell them they can put it down. It's not like broccoli. You don't have to eat every bit on your plate. With food, if they don't like it, it's rude to spit it out. But when you're reading, if you don't like it, you can spit it out. You just put it down and get another one, and no one will say you've got to finish it. Just read what you like. And also, too, sometimes a book is like pizza. I will just love a pizza, but after half of it, I've had enough. And sometimes it's the same with a book. I will love the book, but sometimes I've just had enough, so I turn to the last chapter to find out what happened. When you read a book, you're in control. You can read it any way you want to. And if you want to encourage your kids' writing, particularly poetry, get them to decorate the Boo with blue tack. They can write down their stories, write down their poems, write down their jokes, write down their numerics, and you're going to wallpaper the Boo so everyone can read them.
Fantastic. I love it. Jackie, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Jackie French is the current Australian Children's Laureate. That means she's the face of children's literacy and books in quite an active way. She'll be heading to a whole range of rural communities throughout this year, hoping you'll get on board with her Share a Story campaign. You can find out more at childrenslaureate.org.au. But I'd really love to hear from you this morning via our ABC Rural Facebook page. I want to know, what was your magic book? What are your children's magic books? Maybe we can share them and inspire each other. You'll be able to see some of my magic books on Facebook. Feel free to post your own picture or just share your thoughts. You might even want to take Jackie up on that suggestion of covering your toilet wall in poetry. If you do, take a pic and post it for us. And speaking of Facebook, great to get your comments about our story on blemished mangoes last week, including a lovely letter from a retired agricultural scientist, David, who told me the conversation around blemishes has been going on for many years now. Maybe we should start asking for blemished beauties when we next go shopping. I'm Edwina Farley. This is a Country Breakfast on RN. Now, dinosaur fossils are amazing in themselves, but how would you feel about fossils with extra bling? It seems they're the best kept secret in Australia, the opalised dinosaur fossils of Lightning Ridge in northwest New South Wales. And that's something Australian Opal Centre's manager, paleontologist Jenny Brammel, is keen to see changed. She wants them to get the attention they deserve. As she told Sally Bryant, these fossils are real treasure.
They're about 105 to 110 million years old, the only dinosaur fossils in New South Wales, and they're preserved as opal, which is just astounding.
That's sort of like more bang for your buck, isn't it? I mean, not only do we have dinosaurs, but we have glam bling dinosaurs.
Oh, dude, these are the most outrageous dinosaurs on the planet. a figure that really struck me from Bill Bryson's History of the World was, through his research, he estimated that one in a billion plants or animals leaves a trace of itself as a fossil. Then we have the formation of opal, which is incredibly rare. It happens in very few places on Earth. And we've got these two things coming together in these incredible objects. I mean, it's impossibly unlikely. They're impossibly beautiful, and they tell huge stories about the history of our continent. They're absolute national treasures.
What I can't understand then is, if these things are so amazing, and I've seen them, they are extraordinary, how come we know so little about them, and how come they're not more widely associated with Lightning Ridge?
I think it's just history. I think Lightning Ridge has always been, despite the global status of the gemstones produced here, it's a place of hardworking, humble individuals. And it's a place that's gone under the radar in many ways for a long time. So these things haven't come to the notice of the people who might make a big deal of them until quite recently. It's one of the reasons the Australian Opal Centre was formed, was so that Australians, people in New South Wales, in the opal-producing states of South Australia and Queensland, and everywhere else, can become aware of this, and it becomes a really treasured part of our cultural and natural heritage.
You've got a pretty extensive collection of these sorts of artefacts now. How big is it?
I've lost track a bit, but we'd have between 4,000 and 5,000 individual pieces. It's valued in the vicinity of $2.5 to $3 million, but the real value is in the scientific information that's just really starting to come out of these things, and in its value as a heritage collection and a treasure house for Australia. So there's very fine collections of opalised fossils at the South Australian Museum and at the Australian Museum in Sydney. At the Australian Opal Centre in Lightning Ridge, our collection is the most diverse of those collections. And between those three institutions, we have something that nobody else in the world has and that we're really keen to share.
When you say the Australian Opal Centre, it's a little orange door on the main street of Lightning Ridge, but that's not all it's ever going to be, is it? Let's go over to this model, and okay, you can talk me through what this quite extraordinary building, which is about going to be dug into the ground, and how it's going to work.
Sure. It's okay. So we're looking at a model made of balsa. It's a scale model, and it shows a building that's recessed into the ground. So it's two stories high, 100 metres long, 30 metres wide, and about 12 metres deep. And the great bulk of the building, the whole of the lower story and most of the upper story, is recessed into the ground, which means it's insulated by the earth. It means that it's going to be at a beautiful, constant temperature all year, like the opal mines are. On the roof is a solar farm. So as we're looking at the model, the whole of the roof is covered with little panels that represent solar panels. And the roof is also a rainwater collection surface, so the building will be completely self-providing for water and power.
Now let's talk about what's actually going to be housed within the building itself.
Sure. So if I start at the main entrance, in that immediate vicinity you'll have a small shop, a small cafe, and then a very large flexible space in which travelling exhibitions, performances, conferences, a multifunctional space that's a community space. There'll be all of the back of house things that you expect in an institution like this. So there'll be a research library. We already have one of the two most complete sets of opal-related literature in the world. On the lower floor are the permanent exhibition spaces, a scientific research laboratory, teaching and education spaces, a workshop where you can learn to cut and carve and value opal. So people will come from around the world to this as a centre of opal-related knowledge. And up the eastern end of the building is one of the things that's most exciting, which is a two-storey high underground Gondwanan garden.
Oh my God, what is in a Gondwanan garden?
Okay, a Gondwanan garden is a garden containing the best approximation we can come to of the plants that were living here at Lightning Ridge 105, 110 million years ago. Wollemi pines living and flourishing at Lightning Ridge underground. Tree ferns, ferns, things like that. So it'll be extraordinary to come out of the dust and heat and light and beauty of these arid opal fields into this modern building and then descend into a dinosaur garden.
Paleontologist and manager of the Australian Opal Centre at Lightning Ridge, Jenny Brammel.